Hello and welcome to Software Architecture Insights, your go-to resource for empowering software architects and aspiring professionals with the knowledge and tools they require to navigate the complex landscape of modern software design. My guest today is Kylan Gibbs. Kylan is the CEO and founder of InWorld AI. InWorld develops AI products for builders of consumer applications, enabling the creation of scalable applications that evolve and grow to match increasing user demands. Kylan, welcome to Software Architecture Insights.
Thank you so much, Lee. Pleasure to be here.
So as I read that description of your company, tell me a bit more about what that exactly means. What exactly does InWorld do?
Yeah, so it's a bit more narrow than perhaps it sounds in that description. The reality is, if you look at how most consumers are interacting with AI today, it is almost all in some kind of conversational interface. So that could be a chat, of course. We're all very used to ChatGPT. That could be voice. We're getting very used to that now. I think we're seeing like crazy growth in the last 6 months, especially around voice uptake. And it's all kind of that conversational nature. And I think the kind of insight there is, you know, if you're building an interface to something that is a human-like intelligence, even if it's for entertainment purposes, you're going to use something conversational. So we tend to focus very much on real-time conversational pipelines, models specifically. And the reason that we do that is, well, one, we're very good at it. So our team comes from a background in real-time conversational AI for decades for some of our team. We also basically have found that that is just covering most of the consumer space.
So if I were to say that performance is your number one concern, you would probably come back and say specifically real-time performance is the aspect that's most important to what you do.
That's right. And what's super interesting is we've kind of started to reach this level of like human-like performance. And what we've started to find is kind of, I think for the last few decades even, our goal was, okay, let's try and create AI that sounds like a human. And now that we're getting to that place where it does start to sound like a human, it's performance of a specific role. So we work, for example, with, you know, health and fitness companies and apps, language learning apps, you know, of course, games and media. And what's interesting is what performance means in each of those contexts is very different. If you're talking to a customer support agent versus you're talking to your favorite character from a show, you're going to expect a very different type of conversation. You're going to expect them to use knowledge differently. You're going to expect them to cut in at certain points very differently if it's an assistant versus, you know, a protagonist character. And so there's a lot of nuance, I guess, to what performance means in each context. And it's actually very specific to what the user's expecting. What is the user believing that they're encountering in this moment? Is it a helpful support assistant? Is it a, you know, favorite character in their game? Is it their health coach or someone helping them learn a language? In each of those contexts, the user has a different expectation of what performance or quality really means. And so a lot of what we do is, of course, building that great default, but then helping adapt it to those like vertical or user-specific contexts.
Yeah, in fact, the real-time performance in your context is not, you know, real-time may not be the right term. Maybe just-in-time is a better term because the fastest isn't necessarily the right answer. It's at the right time and be exactly precise in the correct timing of when it goes. And so you have to be ready very fast, which is where performance comes in. But there is a lot of nuance to the exact timing of when you want to give a response or interrupt or do whatever in a conversational AI.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Cool. So that's a B2C sort of framework, right? Where some business is building an AI that's talking to a consumer. I guess it doesn't have to be business to consumer, but let's leave it at that for a moment. But a significant portion of the spending of AI right now is in B2B. And I think you're the one that told me when we had our last conversation that wasn't about 90% of AI spending currently in the B2B marketplace? So how does that translate? Are the needs the same in B2B or are they different? And how exactly does that fit into what you do?
Yeah, so maybe some background here. So I came from DeepMind. When I was at DeepMind, my job was to basically take DeepMind AI and get integrated into Google products. And we were using early LLMs. There was a lot of really cool ideas around search, learning, everything else. And really, a lot of it ended up landing in Google Cloud for business-facing applications. And the key thing there, if you're thinking about building, for example, a contact center AI, it's very predictable. You're kind of focusing on factuality. And also when you start looking at a lot of things that people, so that's kind of on the conversational part. But beyond that, in a lot of cases now, like a lot of business automation is just doing complex tasks. It really has nothing to do, for example, with entertainment or kind of engagement of a user. And so what we tend to find is like a lot of the business automation that we use today is things like business intelligence. Like, am I understanding a huge amount of data? Am I automating very complex processes like some legal process or, you know, an onboarding process for an agency? In each of those contexts, you don't care if it takes 30 minutes because it's maybe still faster than a human doing it. You don't really care about cost because, you know, even if it's $30 per 30 minutes, that's still cheaper than, you know, a human lawyer. The reality is when you come into a consumer context, what we're talking about, kind of like the real-time performance there, the just-in-time performance, as you put it, is, you know, you're much more cost sensitive, first of all. You know, your users, you're looking at maybe a dollar to a few dollars a month in terms of processing cost, like dramatically lower the business. Latency is also, interestingly, much more important in consumer context than business. You know, users are expecting this human-like performance, which is usually under 500 milliseconds to feel natural. Other things are then how you even think about quality. So if I was building, for example, a standard, you know, customer support agent for every business, I could probably create the same persona and users would be happy with it. We have to then take, for example, in some cases, hundreds of characters that are well-known and beloved and help create them, for example, it could be for a language learning app, or it could be for a, you know, parks company, or it could be for, you know, a streaming platform. And in each of those contexts, they're really recreating something that engages the users. And there is just this fundamental distinction, I think, between like what AI architectures look like when they're doing that kind of complex, long-running, I think the important part is long-running business processes, and when they're doing these kind of very fast user-facing ones. And so, yeah, about 90% of the total spend on AI today is in the business-facing side. But I would also say that's just because the tech wasn't ready for the constraints in the consumer side, because it's too expensive. It's too slow. We can't adapt the quality well enough to optimize it. You know, we don't even have some, like a lot of people don't have basic modules like memory that are very important for that long-term relationship with consumers. And so we're genuinely seeing this kind of big inflection point right now where huge amounts of investment over the last few years have gone into the business-facing side, developer tools. Now we're starting to see kind of the winners emerge there. People are realizing that the value is kind of moving up to that application layer, and that the kind of most open space, let's say, is on the consumer side, because let's be clear, like the business place has been kind of really eaten up over the last 4 years. And so we're seeing kind of a gold rush of folks on the consumer side because the tech is ready and basically the market is hungry.
So, you know, that 90-10 number is expected to change dramatically. You expect there to be a huge influx of spending, yes, in the consumer side of the world, less so on, or maybe not less on the business side, but less relatively increase on the business side as time goes on. Yeah. So what does this mean for the developer then, for a team that is working on an AI product, whatever, whether it's consumer or business, whatever, what does this really mean for them?
So the funny part is, so what you can see, for example, is you can see a lot of folks going out and building very complex workflows. So, you know, for example, there's the OpenAI Agent Kit that was released. Google's got a lot of these kind of visual flow builders. And you can create very complex tasks. For example, one of the companies we work with, they do business-facing applications. And, you know, they're for a multi-hundred-thousand-dollar per month contract, even though they're using those very complex business processes, a lot of the challenge is just basically baking in the business logic. It's not really in how you configure the AI or the performance engineering, let's say. And so the biggest difference I see when people are kind of starting to step in the consumer space is like performance matters. And when I say performance, I literally mean, you know, basic performance engineering. How fast can you make it? Are you writing it in C++ or a slower language? You know, are you really optimizing what's done on the client, what's done on the server? Those little things become much more important when you have these applications that are touching millions of concurrent users. So if I just said, okay, Lee, I'm going to basically create a process by which you could onboard every podcaster, generate some scripts, pull all the knowledge from the web for them, and it's going to take an hour to run this process, you're like, great, I don't have to do it now. You know, you'll go for that. If you were basically saying, okay, now you're going to have a talking Lee that's going to talk to, you know, millions of people in the world at the same time, you're going to be much more concerned about those little performance aspects. And so it's just like, the funny part is it's much more like hardcore engineering actually that's required to make this stuff work in the consumer context. And the other challenge that kind of associated with that is a lot of the folks who are stepping into that space don't have that background. People who tend to go into, you know, consumer founding, consumer teams, aren't necessarily from a performance engineering background. And that creates this funny gap where a lot of the tools that are being built by the big guys are focused on serving those business-facing applications because, as we said, it's 90% of the market. And yet you're seeing this growth of demand on the consumer side, but frankly, the tools are just not quite there. And you could build them, but the teams who are building these are, you know, five-person teams without that kind of background. And so we're in this kind of funny gap where I think there are still some technical challenges to resolve to unlock this kind of next consumer wave because the teams need it, basically, that are there building this, and they're not necessarily going to want to build it themselves. They want to keep their eyes on the users.
So it's an interesting take. You're talking about tools and the performance of tools. You know, if you look at enterprise, the classic B2B compared to maybe an SMB market that may be B2B or maybe B2C, one of the things that you notice is that enterprise plays tend to focus a lot on low code, no code. And one of the aspects of that sort of mindset is performance optimized code isn't critical. It's ease of development is what's most critical, right? So building systems is designed to make things easy to build AI systems that work together. That's actually one of the reasons I think why Python is the language of choice for AI. It's a simple language. It integrates very well with AI. It's a lot of the ecosystem's big because of that, but it is easy for a non-developer to make things work in Python. Yet Python and the whole AI ecosystem that goes attached to it really isn't designed for performance. I mean, it's I'm trying to be polite here, but I don't think there's a lot there. Why is that? What does that do for the performance expectations for enterprise and for these low-code environments as opposed to these new demands for what you're talking about for the conversational AI and what's needed there and how to make that work? Mm-hmm.
So I just, for some reason, as you said that, I thought of a funny analogy. So if we went back like a few decades, a couple decades now, you could imagine like what's the difference between McKinsey and Google? Really, what they're both doing is serving information to a person. McKinsey just happens to take $1 million and 6 months to produce their information. But you're willing to wait for it. It's high quality. You know, it's taking away things that you don't want to do, and you're paying for that. Google is serving you search results in fractions of a second to billions of people globally. And when you think about the architecture of each of those companies, you know, McKinsey basically has this very slow, methodical process. It's very much about baking in the logic and taking kind of that human understanding and baking it in. And the systems basically just kind of being a conduit for that. On the Google side, you know, the amount of effort that they've, of course, put into search and, you know, caching and how they're basically managing knowledge bases at our time is incredible and also extremely fast. And they've, and let's also look at the technical innovation of Google versus McKinsey, let's say over the last few years. So I say that because I think it's kind of just an interesting point to saying, like, when you're serving millions of concurrent users in a kind of standardized context, but that requires a lot of adaptation, you're going to kind of place a lot more technical constraints. And so let's just relate that then to, like, you know, say Python versus C++. So if, you know, I was building a custom workflow using a bunch of different models, and my goal is basically just to make it human readable, human understandable, bake in kind of, you know, my understanding, my client's understanding, I'd probably write it in Python. Or even I go one level up and maybe use it just a visual graph builder. So, because then I could sit down with my client and really walk through it with them. If you were doing a Google search and I asked you for every Google search to whiteboard out a flow diagram of how you wanted the search to execute, you'd probably be pretty pissed off. And so I think it's like a neat analogy because really the goal there is saying, okay, I can't possibly give a McKinsey level answer to every single user, but I'm going to get as close as I can and do it as fast as I can. And honestly, with the, you know, the AI integrations and everything they're doing now, they're getting pretty close. And so I think there's just this interesting question of like scale and generality that is forcing you more toward that performance side, and where you're probably going to be writing a lot more in C++. You know, you're going to be much more concerned about your backend systems. Your infrastructure is going to matter more than your people knowledge at a certain point. And so there's, I think, just a fundamental difference there in the way that we're interacting with a lot of these sources, let's say, of information or purpose.
Yeah, I like that analogy. I think that works really well. You know, the McKinsey's of the world, when you hire a McKinsey or you hire any consultant, you hire any Gartner, you hire anybody, you're bringing in an expertise, and you expect performance, you expect results, so you expect them to be high quality results, and you spend a ton of money to do that. When you go to Google, you expect to spend no money, get the answer right away, and still have a decent quality result, but you're willing to accept mistakes or problems or inaccuracies or more work on your part to have to go through and figure out which of these 20 answers is the one that really matters to you, right? Yeah. So you're making a relatively small trade-off in effort and quality in order to get a huge trade-off in cost.
Yes.
And cost can be dollars or effort or whatever, you know, however you make that work.
Yes, exactly.
So that same thing was applying here is what you're saying. So in the AI world, you can build the perfect AI system that does exactly, gives you exactly the research you want, the results you want. And in fact, you know, I think OpenAI made some announcements as far as better research-based models recently. But there are expectations with those models of quality of answers, quality of results, and boy, is it going to be expensive to come up with this result. Expensive not only in a standpoint of time, but also in AI costs and the dollars associated with running those costs. On the exact opposite end of that, there is this the new focus on the conversational piece, which is, no, I just want to say something, and I want it to be meaningful and useful, but maybe not perfect, but I need to do it in 500 milliseconds, and it has to be in the flow of the conversation with the right intonation and all that sort of stuff. Those are two very, very, very different models. Now, the first one is the background model, and that's what you say we've been historically working on. But this one is the B2C model. This is the model that's really starting to come up now. And this is really the model you're talking about, that what you're doing is focusing on.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, I think that just what's happened is, it's funny, when we first started, like, looking at AI and we were looking at what would be automated in that, you know, we thought it'd be robots and factories and that, and it's turned out to be the complete opposite. And so it's like, you know, 80-20 or more like 95-10. In terms of there's 95% of, like, you know, let's say value in, like, these very small business cases, which is, like, you know, CEO level work, you know, things that are happening very. So OpenAI and those, I think, have really pushed to take over those complex tasks. You hear, for example, Sam talk about PhD level agents that'll cost $20,000 a month. If you think about what that means, it's saying, okay, we're just going to go after these super high value use cases that are extremely hard to find anybody in the world who can do. And we're just going to make those accessible. Now, that's a very different problem from now saying, across that long tail of consumers, well, they probably don't need that complex answer in a given moment. They want to be entertained. They want to go through their workout efficiently. They want to learn a language. And also, there's millions of people who want to do that at the same time. And so I think that the challenge there is, okay, your interface is going to be very different. You're not going to create a visual graphic or whatever. You're just going to create a chatbot, or you're just going to create a talking character, or you're just going to create a copilot that lives alongside your app. You're going to fit it into the form factor that's native to the user. And naturally, what's really interesting about this is, you know, AI is still best if we thought of, I think, in the metaphor of, like, it's always playing a human role of some kind. And when consumers are interacting with it, the most natural thing, for example, how you and I are talking now, like, most all human interactions are conversational in nature. Even if it's a letter, you know, a conversation, it's a text, it's an email. It's very hard to interact with the world without it being a conversation of some kind, especially with, you know, other people. And so naturally, when you think about, okay, an AI is starting to play a human role in some context, even that's just being a companion or a therapist or a health coach or a, you know, a learning assistant. In every one of those contexts, like, the person is expecting something that is human-like, and therefore they tend towards conversation. And I think that's why we just found product market fit. Like, ChatGPT was a huge unlock, of course, for the whole AI industry, simply because it introduced a conversational interface. And that's just continuing to evolve. And so the way that I see this is, like, chat, of course, was the first conversational interface. I think now we're going into voice. Next, it'll go into video, you know, and basically live streaming of avatars, as well as kind of understanding real-time space and what's going on in front of me. As the user. And so I just think about it as getting closer and closer to the experience of having a human alongside you in whatever context that is, and being fully aware of the context and every modality associated with it. And so that is to say, that's a huge challenge, though, when we go back to kind of the Google McKinsey thing. So now I've got to make it work to have this unique conversation for a specific role for millions of concurrent users that's going to cost less than a few dollars per month. And it's going to respond in 500 milliseconds. Like, you start to very quickly be like, okay, these are hard engineering problems. And so it's just, I think, two different directions, frankly, for AI. Like, I think there's one big pressure, which is let's automate all the business processes. And the end result there is reduced cost, higher profit. But it basically doesn't introduce any new revenue into the industry or to, you know, market overall. So to do that, we need to create things that are actually engaging to consumers enough that they're spending more money. And to do that, we need to solve all the technical problems to make that possible. And so we're very much focused on solving those technical problems for those real-time conversational interfaces, which we fundamentally believe are the right path towards bringing the benefits of AI to everyone in the world, which is, I think, a different like existential pressure than the kind of automation side, which is to say, okay, great, we can just automate business. Well, where does that leave everyone else then if the kind of the benefits of AI aren't flowing to them? We've got to make sure that at the same time, we're seeing this portfolio of applications and use cases evolve that improve everyone's lives.
So as a software developer who's trying to decide their next career direction, or as a software team that's trying to figure out where their team fits in within the company, or you know, what their company is doing fits in within the industry, what advice can you get from all of this for those groups?
Yeah, so I think we can start at the top. So when I say the top, I mean the application. So, you know, if you're a founder or you're an engineer setting off to build a consumer AI application, I think the first thing that you should note is where people kind of get stuck, I think, is they reach a quality bar that they're happy with, and then they can't produce it at the same, at the cost or latency that they need. And so you really kind of want to bring on, let's say, a team that is aware of those challenges of how to do kind of that low-level engineering. You've also got to be aware that, you know, you're not probably going to have a single pipeline that's, you know, plugging in a single API from OpenAI and you're going to get everything that you want. You're going to have to do a lot of customization, figure out which models work, you know, making sure that you're choosing the right text-to-speech for latency, you're choosing the right LLM for latency. Are you hosting it yourself? Are you putting in the cloud? Where is it located? Like, all those, there's very complex problems to make consumer work. And, you know, I think you saw this a little bit in the early mobile era where a lot of the like basic gotcha games and things in like Zynga and that actually innovated a lot on tech to make it possible to reach all those. So I think as a founder engineer at that level, that's what I would say is, you know, focus on your users, but be very aware that to serve them properly, you're going to have to do some pretty low level work. I think as a developer now building for tools in this space, the reality is like things like front end code is getting easier and easier to automate. You know, we're starting to kind of eat into back end code a little bit. I think that the challenge is then, okay, now I'm starting to do that performance engineering. I'm setting up my servers. I'm that's where I think we still need human hands a lot. And it gets very complex when you're handling, for example, you know, concurrent operations across clusters and that becomes difficult. And so I think that, you know, focus on where the AI, because, you know, I can generate front-end code. I definitely can't set up a server to you know, reach under 500 millisecond latency and design an inference stack. And even more so, I think that more work needs to be done on understanding the actual architecture of models. How does inference run? You know, which hardware is efficient for this? Why? It's getting down to that level of, okay, now if a lot of those top-level problems are kind of going away, the value as an engineer, I think, is getting really good at that performance engineering. Because even as you're connecting models, there's going to be a point at which like you can shave off 100 milliseconds here and there in some certain configuration, or how a model is hosted, or how the inference stack is built. And I still see most teams thinking that like AI is this kind of magic wand where I just pull a model out of OpenAI or Google and it works great. The reality is, let's just go back to good old software engineering. A model is basically a set of weights. Yeah, you got to host it. You got to say that you get it set up on an inference stack. You've got to figure out your hardware. You got to set up your networking. You got to make sure that you're co-located with your databases. Very basic stuff, but most teams aren't doing that. And I think it's because we've been kind of trained to say, don't worry about the AI. You know, let us handle it. We're going to figure out all the AI stuff. You guys use an API. Well, that's okay, but are you really going to get the best performance out of that? And so I think it's kind of like the simple message I would say is like engineering is not done. We just kind of forgot that AI is engineering in some ways and requires engineering.
That's a great message. You know, that's, you know, that goes straight to what I hear mostly from developers, which is like, what is my job now that AI is here? How does my job exist? And if so, what am I doing? And that's kind of going directly towards that. So I'm encouraging the developers who are listening to this, listen to this advice. You know, your job hasn't gone away. It's changed. But it really hasn't changed that much is kind of what you're saying. It's the same things you've done before, just applied to a different space.
Yeah, like a LLM is a really complex for loop. So, you know, it's like it's all these operations that we got very used to in standard engineering, and now we're just introducing operations that are model calls.
Yeah.
And defining the input output formats. Like we've done that before, and like you know we've done typing on as we're coding, and so I think we're just developing a new nomenclature and a new architecture. If our components are now, you know, for example, maybe not imported functions, but are model calls or they're locally hosted models, and it just changes, I think, the nature of engineering. But it is still very much required, and I think the faster that engineers can kind of get to that state where they're choosing tools that give them that flexibility, give them that level of control, then they get to actually do engineering. I think just saying, like, I see a lot of teams, like, especially on the more less technical side, where they're like, they plug in an API, it works, and they walk away. And you're like, guys, like, this is there's a lot of work left to do. And I think it's a natural, I think, evolution. But I'm pretty excited, I think, to see that people are starting to figure this out. And I also think we're starting to kind of see enter that kind of flatter curve on the kind of model gains. It's still going to keep going. It's just going to be more expensive and longer now, proportionally. And that means, I think, that now a lot of the gains need to come from, like, the engineering work done on top of the models, because models aren't going to just be the panacea that they were kind of, I think, posed to be within at least the next couple of years.
What do 160,000 of your peers have in common? They've all boosted their skill sets and career prospects by taking one of my online courses. Go to AtchisonAcademy.com or look into the show notes. Expand your knowledge and expertise at Atchison Academy. Yeah, there's been a lot of growth and model changes over the last couple of years, but what you're saying is there's going to be less of that. Instead, we'll be focusing more on the connections. And I think that kind of plays straight into my next question, which was, you know, around kind of the open, in the background of the OpenAI announcements that have occurred recently. Now, we're recording this episode in October, mid-October, but there was announcements by OpenAI just a couple of weeks ago. I'd like you to talk about that a little bit, but also about what of that is really a shift in a direction we're taking AI, as opposed to here's version X of this next thing.
Yeah. So I would point to a specific trend. So if you look across the last, I mean, even more than 4 years, let's say 8 years, we started out at a place where we were iterating on architectures. We had RNNs, then we had, you know, Transformers came out and kind of won the race. But there was actually iteration on architectures. Now then the next stage was iterating on how to scale up compute, how to set up operations. Like GPT-3 was fundamentally an engineering innovation in many ways, right? In terms of how they were able to scale the model. And I think over the last 3 or so years, companies have been able to make so much progress by just continuously scaling up the compute that was the paradigm we were in. That was how innovation worked, was basically how do I build bigger models? How do I find better data sets? So on and so forth. And what I think you saw happen last year and kind of slightly the year before, when you started seeing the reasoning models, this thinking process, you're starting to push more of the inference basically towards actually more of the compute towards inference time rather than at training time. And what I would say we're seeing now with the evolution of these agent kits, you know, the frameworks to connect these things is a further push. So now you're not only taking reasoning models, you're connecting multiple reasoning models to do a certain process. And so it's kind of to say, like, as we kind of get, like, as the modeling part gets harder, the answer is, okay, we're just going to use more model calls to do more complex operations. And this is kind of what I was alluding to before in saying that, you know, we used to assume that if a model got big enough and powerful enough, it would basically solve every problem. Well, that might be true, but what if that takes 10 years to get to that model? Well, then you're going to have to do a lot more complex model calls. What reasoning really is just putting some more tokens in and basically doing some internal processing. What an agent is just layering on kind of now a connection or a graph or pipeline of those models. And I think you're just seeing this happen across every space. So there's basically what I think is happening there is the technical constraints are pushing the industry towards more and more like inference time compute. And the reasoning models, the next layer on top of that is naturally kind of building these connections and doing more custom workflows within that, pulling in new knowledge sources, you know, Zapier style kind of operations as they're doing now. And I think this is just, like, if OpenAI had been able to release, you know, GPT 5.5 at this announcement, I'm sure they would have. But guess what? It's probably going to take another 6 months and another $20 billion. So it's easier for them to build up these SDKs. And I also see this as a pattern across a lot of companies. So you see companies come out with new model types. For example, video now is a big one. You see lots of companies come out with video. What I expect to happen in the next year is you're going to have bigger companies that are going to figure out how to connect video models and build, you know, these long-term templates around them. And so it's kind of to say, like, you have the main vector there, which is actually the model performance. But if that starts to slow down on the curve, you start to be able to get those gains primarily off of the off of basically pushing more and more compute, which is just by more chaining more and more model calls into the inference time. And I will honestly say, though, I don't think this is solving the problems that you need on the consumer side still. So that, like, that's the interesting part. Like, this is basically meaning it's going to get really freaking good for me to be able to, like, take a bunch of market intelligence, dump it in, you know, set up some sales leads, reach out to a bunch of customers. You know, I can actually do that pretty well. And it's, you know, maybe more efficient than a person doing it. But it still doesn't get to that level of, okay, well, that's not really solving the problem of how do I take a specific model or a very simple pipeline and get it to work, you know, 10 times faster for 10 times more users in a way that, you know, matches the quality of each of them. So it's like it's just a different, I think, paradigm. And I don't think this is not, like, unique to OpenAI. You know, Google, I think, is just pushed into the space. You know, they're doing a lot more on the visual graph builders and that. And the other thing that I would say that they're trying to do, so that's kind of on the technical constraint side. So there's kind of like a technical capabilities and then, like, let's say market demand. I think what they're also trying to do is make these tools more accessible. So, like, there's always been things like these frameworks to connect models and build it, and you can technically code it yourself. Most of the world doesn't code, and actually less and less of the world codes, it turns out, because everybody's using these copilots on that. And so I think the other part of this is just they're trying to make the, like, customization of these tools using things like graphs and pipelines more accessible to a larger audience, so that you can now have marketing folks who are building pipelines for themselves. You know, you can have legal folks who are building pipelines for themselves, and it's just opening up, I guess, that those capabilities to a wider audience. So it's a very, let's say, rational direction. But my argument is it's still not opening it up to people that I really care about, which is, like, everybody in their daily life. And that is, I think, still the open challenge to solve.
So I want to end with getting back to the performance aspect a little bit again to connect what you've just talked about back to that. We're now in the world where doing more of the calculation at inference time versus at model creation time is important. Yet we're also in a world where the amount of actual processing time we can take to make that happen is becoming more and more scarce because the real-time nature is very important. And so the computation needed at the time of the conversation is more and more critical than it's ever been before. And that's going to continue, and that's going to grow, and that's where the innovation needs to be. Take that concept and merge it with what you're doing, and using a term that you've mentioned multiple times in this episode, but I've been wanting to get onto, but we're going to end with it instead. And that is the use of C++ in AI programming. Now, you don't think of C++ as an AI programming language at all, ever. You don't hear anyone talk about using C++ anywhere in anything having to do with AI, typically. Yet you talk about it pretty openly. So a lot of what you do is in C++. Tell me why C++ is the right answer for what you're doing.
Yeah, so I think that you could start with, like, what we're actually trying to serve. So when we take these real-time conversational contexts, you tend to have in the simplest context, you could have a graph of imagine a speech-to-speech context. So you take ASR with an LLM and TTS. Then, of course, you can layer on things like memory and safety and tool calls and all of that. But let's imagine a very, very simple complex or context like that. So in that context of that simple speech-to-speech pipeline, the ideal human case, like, humans tend to respond between 250 and 500 milliseconds after you stop an utterance. So there you have a latency constraint or a goal of basically reaching, let's say, around, like, between 250 and 500 milliseconds. That's very fast. Like, very, very fast. So when you think about the model calls, there's an aspect of, you know, of course, we can actually optimize the model sizes. We can figure out how they're hosted. We can make sure that they're running on better hardware. We can make sure that they're located closer to the user. You know, all the basic, you know, networking stuff. But at some point, you have this graph. And let's say you have it at 600 milliseconds. and you have the models that you have, and you've connected them. And now you're basically using, let's say, a Python-based framework to build this. The challenge is that you just lose a lot of the control of the basic kind of underlying optimizations of, okay, if this program is, for example, running on your client, and let's say it's a robot, you know, for the context of this, right? Because it's a fun one. You're running on some client, you have a robot, and you know, the robot has to respond in 300 milliseconds, and the executions are happening locally. If in that context, you're definitely going to want to see C++, also because then it's going to be able to speak to the rest of the system. You're going to be able to manage the memory. You're going to make sure that you, if you're doing it, for example, in a robot context, you're probably having to use some other locomotion stuff at the same time off the same chips. In a gaming context, it's kind of similar. So you're now having to split, you know, memory between the actual graphics rendering, as well as the character animation, as well as this model inference. So you want that control, but you also just want the simple speed. So, you know, you might get very basic gains off of like a Python to C++ change, but those gains add up, especially as you start training on more and more components. So like that three model structure that we talked about, that could get very complex. You might have a bunch of, you know, branching different contexts in which different model calls are made at different times. You may have custom microservices that are operating on the server as well that you're calling at certain points. And in all those contexts, just like as you add up the complexity, you kind of have this explosion of those small latency and cost changes really mattering. If you especially had, let's say, 20 model calls in a chain. And so what we did is when we built our runtime, which is kind of the best way to actually orchestrate these models and components, we built it all with a C++ core. Now, we recognize, of course, that people don't necessarily all code in C++. So we built SDKs on top of that to make it accessible. But the benefit of that is even if it's running on the server, you're just shaving off those performance aspects. And it gives us the ability to optimize the actual pipeline end-to-end and do kind of, you know, basic memory management and things that you do. The other thing is that it makes it portable also onto a device. So if you did want to have this as a compiled, you can then compile it, you could ship it on a client, you could run it on a server. It's packaged, it's optimized, you're shaving off, you know, potentially hundreds of milliseconds depending on the complexity of the call. So it's just to say that, like, as we were noting before, these things don't matter if you don't care about that kind of real-time performance, but most consumers care about that real-time performance, and that's why we've built that all in C++. We continue to basically build out the core of all of our systems and infrastructure in C++ for that reason, which it gives us more control, it gives us that opportunity to shave off latency, it gives us the option to compile the programs and run them on cloud or in on the client. Which is very important because if you think about a game, there might be a game where it happens to run on a powerful local computer, or it might happen to run in the cloud and be streamed to the computer. In both contexts, you're going to want that same performance, but you're also going to want to basically adapt to a different user device. And so it just is really kind of all about those like basic things that don't matter if you're looking at these like complex business automation cases, but really, really matter when you're kind of doing something that requires that real-time performance, and when you're doing with millions of concurrent users, where you're having to manage basically, you know, all the rate limits and the kind of threshold of capacity, because that's a lot of processing that's happening there.
So the fine control over CPU, the fine control over memory, and the ability to optimize that in order to make it highly performant in both the SaaS environment as well as highly performant in a constrained local environment like a robot or AI assistant or whatever. Both of those are better suited towards a language structure that allows you to have finer control over the CPU and finer control over memory, and really nothing beats C++ in both those aspects.
That's right.
My guest today has been Kylan Gibbs. Kylan is the founder and CEO of InWorld AI, a framework for improving the development and scaling of large-scale AI systems. Kylan, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for this, and thank you for joining me on Software Architecture Insights.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Lee, and thanks for everyone listening.
Thank you for joining us on Software Architecture Insights. If you found this episode interesting, please tell your friends and colleagues. You can listen to Software Architecture Insights on all of the major podcast platforms. And if you want more from me, take a look at some of my many articles at softwarearchitectureinsights.com. And while you're there, join the 2,000 people who have subscribed to my newsletter so you always get my latest content as soon as it's available. Thank you for listening to Software Architecture Insights. What does it take to operate a modern organization running a modern digital application? Read more in my O'Reilly Media book, Architecting for Scale, now in its second edition. Go to leeatchison.com/books for more information.